You're listening to Better Than Fiction with your hosts, D.L. Nelson and Scott Sackett.
All right, welcome back to Better Than Fiction, your pop culture podcast. As always, I'll be your host, D.L. Nelson, joined by my other host,
Scott Sackett.
Yo, Scott, this will be episode 472. Woo! Hey, thanks for bringing it this episode. That was a good woo.
Well, I got to tell you, on Amazon Prime, they had a Ric Flair, I don't know why, there was a Ric Flair thing, and there's a bunch of Ric Flair matches.
That's cool.
And so I watched some of that the other day.
So if you watched the thing where him and another guy are out looking for his butterfly or whatever suit. I remember I told you about that. Have you watched that yet?
No, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's not butterfly. It's his.
I thought you were going to talk about a wrestling gimmick. They were looking for his butterfly suit.
No, it's like whatever that suit's called, the big blue one or whatever.
Yeah.
That has been missing for.
Didn't it get stolen at a hotel?
No,
I
don't think it got stolen. But this collector had it, and they found out this collector had it, and this guy he's like a high end collector. He's got all kind of memorabilia. He's got like a second floor of his house. It's got like all this wrestling memorabilia or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
He's even got like old wrestling like posters and stuff like that framed on the walls. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. Like old, not only posters, but like, what do you call them?
Like the little things with the wrestling card on it.
Yeah, it's almost like the old concert.
Oh, yeah.
Posters they would do for gigs. But he had some wrestling ones, if I remember correctly, but he had all these different items, and anyways, they're wanting their robe back. So some guy that's putting together the museum or whatever for the WWE thought he had a line on it. So he goes by Ric Flair's house. It's a whole documentary. There's a guy, you know, someone's filming it. They go by and pick up Ric Flair, and they drive to this guy's place, and you know he knows they're coming, so lets him in. He's like, oh yeah, and he pulls it out, and it's literally in a. You know, it's in like a wedding dress kind of a bag or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know, they say, oh, yeah, it's, you know, this thing's probably...
Oh, it'd have to be, because it's so pretty huge.
Yeah, he's got the boa thing coming off of it and all business. And, you know, I think they said it's worth like maybe $100,000 or whatever. But I think we talked about that before. I just wondered if you bought it to watch it. It's pretty cool, though. You ought to check it out.
No, I haven't seen it. What was it on? What streaming service?
Got so many, I can't tell you.
I gotcha.
It might even be on YouTube for all I know, but yeah.
Everything ends up on YouTube.
So, I've been busy with work things this week, so I've only got really one book that I started reading last night. I finished it today. I thought I would talk about those. I see you got a couple things. You want to start?
Yeah, I got a couple things. Yeah, and I'm kind of like you. I'm not as busy. You're talking about what you've been doing. I'm not as busy as you, but this is my busy season at work, and so I've been working more hours. And also, I'm drawing a comic book on the side. So I have not been reading a lot of things. However, I did... So my local comic shop that I go to is really more of a game shop nowadays.
Yeah.
Gets new comics, gets Marvel, DC, a few Image, a few other things, but mostly Marvel and DC. Does not get any trades. Doesn't get new trades in. Has a bunch of old trades, though.
Yeah.
So when I go there on Wednesdays, a lot of times I'm looking at trades... What's he got? Because he's got them, like, stacked up. So I found this in there this week, and it's called The Art of John Romita. This is a book that came out...
I have never seen that.
I have seen it before.
It's a hardcover. Wow.
It's a hardcover. It's put out by Marvel. Now, Two Morrows had done a Romita book. This was put out in... 96.
That's from Marvel.
So this is from Marvel. So it was in the 90s from Marvel. I've seen this around. It's shrunk wrapped. It's always shrunk wrapped.
Oh.
This was shrunk wrapped. Cover is $34.
Gosh, it's expensive for how small that is.
It's expensive. It's not very thick. I paid significantly less than that.
They have another copy?
No. Unfortunately. And if you want to find one, it's going to cost you nowadays.
Is it? Okay.
Oh, yeah, it's out of print. And this is a pretty cool little book. I don't know what the Tomorrow's book is like. I think it's called John Romita and All That Jazz or something like that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You don't have that, do you?
I don't think so.
Oh, yeah, that's another one's out of print. Anyway, this has got a, it's basically a bio of John Romita. It goes through the beginning and it shows some of his early work. He did some, he worked, at one point when he was 17, his first art job was he had a doctor that somehow, that was like a family friend that needed some, was going to do some kind of presentation and was writing a book and he needed all these illustrations and stuff. So, like in the 40s, I think it was, or whenever he was a kid, this guy hired him and he paid him, I think it was like $60 a week to do these. And he worked on it for 3 months. And, when he got done, all these other doctors at the same hospital came to him and said, oh yeah, we're writing books too. And so he thought, oh man, this is great. I hit the gravy train. And he said, none of the other ones ever contacted him again, you know, but for that one, that was kind of his start in his art career. It has some early, illustrations he did for some different jobs and some, you know, personal work. It was 47, when that happened. Anyway, but it's not really like an art book. It's more like a biography, and it goes through, it's got an interview with him, and then it shows like his early work, and he did the covers for all those Stan Lee
books that
came out, you know, like The Son of Origins.
Yeah, I didn't know he did that.
Let's see, was there Origins up here? Oh, like this one, Marvel's Greatest Superhero Battle,
yep,
by Stan Lee from 79.
Yep.
He did the cover for that. It's got a lot of those.
What was that It thing you got there? What's that all about?
That's his first assignment for Marvel from 1951. It was in Strange Tales number 4.
Oh, that's cool.
So he worked for Marvel in the 50s.
His style had really changed since then.
Oh, yeah. definitely.
Being that fashion illustrator, that probably made him change it up a little bit.
Oh, but sure. And it's got a lot of his cover roughs that he did. It has, later on, it has some cover roughs that he did for even like Jack Kirby. Here's one. He designed the Spider-Man balloon for the Macy's Thanksgiving float.
That's not the one that flew away, is it? It didn't fly away, did it?
I don't know.
This one's kind of laying down.
Yeah, he's kind of crawling like he's crawling up a wall. Did one of them fly away?
I thought one of those balloons did. Maybe it wasn't the Spider-Man one.
I don't know. Oh, and here's another thing. He was involved, like in the 70s, Marvel did a rock album.
What?
And I think it was called, what was it called?
Kirby Crackle?
No, it wasn't Kirby Crackle. That's a band. I forget what it was called, but he did like illustrations for the inside. Like, it was called Rock Comic Art. But they did a, this was the liner notes for the album. I've seen the cover of the album in another book, so Spider-Man looking in a mirror. But inside, like, it's got Luke Cage, Power Man playing a bass guitar. It's got Black Panther, drawing a Black Panther playing an electric guitar. He did those illustrations. But what he did, I heard about this, but I never seen a picture of this. Stan Lee did like one or two nights at Carnegie Hall back in the 70s.
Stan Lee did?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. In 1975, it's called A Marvelous Evening with Stan Lee at Carnegie Hall. It was one night, January 5th. You've never heard about this?
Was it stand-up? What was he doing?
He was just,
I don't know. Excelsior!
I've never heard of this. So there's a Stan Lee biography that I read recently, and it was not super complimentary about Stan Lee, but it was saying that Stan Lee, like in the 70s, 72, that, you know, Marvel was going big guns. Stan Lee was trying to do other things. Marvel was big on college campuses. So they rented out Carnegie Hall, and I guess he talked. They had people in costume, like everything. It was very low budget. And at one point, like John Romita with like an overhead projector drew Captain America. And there's a picture from that. You can see him, and then you can see it's projected on the wall behind him.
Mm-hmm.
There's the final. He did a marker version
Okay.
But that was the other pictures, the pencils.
So why was he there if it was Stan Lee's thing?
Oh, it was a big Marvel. There was a lot of Marvel. Oh, it's a Marvel. Stuff. Okay. Yeah, some of the Marvel people that played in bands, their band did some stuff.
So it was an evening with Stan Lee and friends.
Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. By the way, I do have that John Romita book.
Do you really?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Is that hard to get, you say?
Well, it's out of print.
Yeah.
I mean, so, yeah, you know. Let's see. Got a lot of pictures, a lot of character designs, and then the back part, there's, you know, a lot of art. It's got art from the comics, and then it'll have pencils. It has character designs. Anyway, this is kind of a cool little book. I picked it up. Like I said, it was sealed when I got it. It's called The Art of John Romita. It's put out by Marvel Comics in 1976.
Oh.
Or 1996.
Still, though. Still not new.
Not new at all. You know, it's funny. You know, you go into comic shops, there's a reason, you know. If I got my comics online, that wouldn't have happened, so.
Oh, well, I just picked up a book from one of our local shops. And, dude, I bought a trade at one of our local shops probably about maybe a month or two ago, not very long ago. And I've been looking for this trade for quite a while. And on eBay, online, it goes for maybe double or more than the price. And one of the shops had it on their shelf still at cover. But you can't find it anywhere. Like Amazon, Half Price Books Online, places like that. Nobody had it. It's eBay, and it was twice up or maybe 2.5 times up above cover. And so it's like, yeah, you can just look into stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that book that you got in your hand there?
Yeah.
I'm looking at one on Amazon. Yeah, it's a pretty penny now.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's about $100.
Oh, yeah. Well, as we know, listing on eBay and selling on eBay are two different things.
Yeah, matter of fact, there was another book I was looking for. Couldn't find it. Found about 5 to 10 copies of it on eBay. And it's been remaindered, so the price is less than cover, but still, people are wanting a lot of money for it. But I noticed there's a few of them up there, right?
Yeah.
So I started inquiring to people what's the lowest amount they would take for it.
Oh yeah.
Because you can message
people. Yeah, you can do that.
And so I basically offered two different people that had it marked lower. Now, if they had it marked pretty high, I knew they were going to come.
Right, yeah. At some point, you're like,
but a couple, and these books were basically still sealed, brand new books, remainder, like people got stacks of them or whatever, 1 to 10 copies or whatever they've got at their house or whatever they're trying to get rid of. And, well, I'll just tell you, it's an omnibus, so the cover on it's like 125. I was not going 125.
Oh, yeah.
Not doing that. But I thought, you know, if I could get it for less than half, considerably less than half, by the way, I would, including shipping, I would maybe go for it, right? So I saw a few people had it for maybe around half or so plus shipping. So I started inquiring, hey, what's the least you'll take for that? And I told them what my top dollar was. And one guy's like, no, if I did that, I wouldn't really make any money. I'm like, okay, cool. I asked another guy or another individual, and they're like, I'll do it for this. And I was like, nah, this is my top dollar. And he goes, we're only $5 apart. And I go, nope, not doing it.
That sounds like me buying a car.
Well, and get this.
They'll go, we're only this apart. It's like, well, then go down.
Yeah. we were literally like $5 apart, like this person said. But I wanted my shipping included. And, you know, I think his had was a shipping outside of it or whatever. And I was like, nah, that's okay. And then, like, in the middle of the night, I got this thing that said, please pay now. And I'm like, please pay now.
Yeah.
And I looked at it, and at first it had the original price, and when I clicked on it, he had put the reduced price in, so, you know, it's me inquiring about it. I guess he realized there's enough people on here that got this book that I could buy it elsewhere, and maybe there's no takers right now, so, you know. So.
Yeah, so, I mean, eBay's like that. It's kind of weird like that.
I mean, I just inquired. I mean, I just threw some.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. They don't have to sell it to you.
No, you know, if the guy wants to sell it, then hey, sell it. If you don't, then I'll move on to somebody else. And so, you know, deals like that, seeing a book in a shop. Like I said, that book I was looking for was out of print. And on eBay, it goes for twice as much or two and a half times as much. And so to me, that I found it on the shelf at Cover was like, I've been looking all over for this thing, and they've got one on the shelf. This is amazing. And the funny thing was, I'd been in that shop numerous times and not saw it. And then one time I went in there, they had it, and I go, where'd this come from? And they go, oh, well, we had a bunch of overstock in the back we brought
out.
Yeah,
that's what
happened. And I'm like, wow, you guys had this the whole time in the back room. I didn't know that. So, yeah, it worked out for me. So,
sometimes you get lucky like that.
So, let's switch gears again. I bought a book, like I said. I've been busy. I think I told you before, but I was busy this whole week. So, from like Saturday, Sunday, all the way to like last night, basically. So I haven't really read any comics or anything like that. Not too much of anything. But I picked up a book the other day. And actually I got it at a comic shop. And it was on their clearance rack. And it was considerably less than Cover. I haven't really ever thought about buying it. I know they've had it for a long time. I hadn't really thought much about buying it. But then I thought, you know what? I'm going to give this book a shot because of what it's about and who did it. So that's about all I knew about it. So I picked it up, started flipping through. I thought, yeah, I want to buy this. So I bought it. Started reading it last night, finished it today. And it's one of those kind of books I think can kind of stick with you. Meaning it's a nonfiction book based on actual true events. Kind of like how Mouse is true events. Or that Tardif series of books I brought.
Or the Alamo book I brought recently.
Or that Tardif, those Tardif books I brought, which was the Prisoner of War in Stalag 2B, which is the story of Tardif's dad who was a prisoner of war, which, you know, very good, very good books. This book is another war book that deals with war. It's based on a true story. I know you've heard of this, but I doubt you've read this. This book is called Facts from Sarajevo from Joe Kubert. You've heard of this, right?
I definitely heard of it. I'm trying to think if I may have checked out of the library.
So I'd seen
this. But I don't recall it.
I'd seen this on this particular comic shop's clearance rack for a long time. And when I told him I was going to buy it, he goes, I've had that book since before. This store's had this book since before I owned the store. That's how long this book has been floating around.
Really?
The store. Yeah. This book has been floating around the store that long. It's brand new, never been sold, I don't think. I don't think it's used. I think it's a brand new book. But it didn't have shrink wrap on it. This dust jacket was a little banged up. Not bad, just in the corners. So I think it's just been on the shelf forever and a day. It never got sold. It's, like I said, it's called the Facts.
It's F-A-X.
Yeah.
Just to clarify, not F-A-C-T-S.
Yes, because like it's a fax machine.
Right.
From Sarajevo.
That's how old the book is.
Yeah. The stories are, it's a story of survival. It's Facts from Sarajevo, and I'll get into that in just a minute. It's a Dark Horse book. I take that back. It's about 210 pages or so. And the book, mine's the first edition. It was printed in October of 96. So, in the early 90s, like I want to say 91, 92, 93, up to about 95, I think. I think it started about 92, might have been over with by about 95. Somewhere in there, Yugoslavia broke up and Serbia, the Serbs, started bombing Bosnia, Herzegovina, I think is what they pronounce it, Herzegovina. And so in Bosnia, there's a city called Sarajevo. And there's another city that starts with a D, like Dorsavak or something like that, that's pretty close to it. Or actually, it's Dorsavak or whatever it's called, might be a suburb of Sarajevo. They're pretty close. Anyway, so these Serbs are in the mountainside, up in the mountains, and they've got these grenade launchers, these rockets, and they're bombing the hell out of the city. And it started off as just like some terrorist stuff. And so people were like, man, there's, you know, something going on, you know, things are getting shot at and blown up. And then it becomes like a full-fledged war. But the problem is there's not like a big response back
to
all this shit going on. And so what this book is about is there's this gentleman, and his name is Irvin Rustamagic, Rusty Magic. And who he is he's a guy that in 71 started his own like comic strip company where I think, and I don't really know exactly how it worked, but I don't think he actually did the comics. He basically had people doing comics. I think he might have sold them to newspapers or something like that. And he also represented some artists in that country. So like artists from around the world who got published in that country might go through him.
Oh, okay.
As a publisher.
Okay.
And one of his clients was none other than Joe Kubert.
Oh, okay.
Another one was another guy you might have heard of called Herman.
Oh, yeah.
And another one was Hugo Pratt. Okay. And there was a couple others that are escaping me right now. But basically, he had connections throughout the world, this guy. This Rustamagic, I think is how he pronounces it. I'm not sure about that. Don't hold me to that. But anyways, he's an English speaker, but some of his English isn't 100%. Like, he might throw the wrong words in here or there, that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
But he'd traveled all over the world. Like, he'd been to Italy, Rome, Croatia, you know, everywhere, right? He'd been all over Europe. He had contacts from all over the world. People knew him everywhere. So what happens is he's got an office there in his country, down the road from where he lives at, like in Sarajevo, or I think it's in Sarajevo where his office is. And he also has another office in Holland. He has another office in Holland. And so him and his wife and his two kids were like in Holland when all this stuff kind of starts breaking out. And it's not real bad. So his wife takes the kids and they go back to Sarajevo. And then when they get there, like, the city's completely shelled. It's surrounded. They're stuck in. They're trapped in there. And him and his business partner, they go back because his wife and his kids are there. And so they go back from Holland. They go back to their country. And now the whole thing just goes down the shitter. Like,
oh yeah,
like, it's getting shelled. Like, people in the street are getting killed. And you find out there's these sharpshooters up in the on top of these buildings, these snipers, and they're shooting kids, and they're getting paid like $300 a pop to kill a kid or shoot a kid, because then the parents run out and grab them, and then they can shoot the parents too or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, they're doing stuff like they're turning off the water, they're cutting out the electricity, they're starting out sending out this a lot of disinformation, like they've taken over some of the local TV or papers or whatever. Send out all this disinformation. So a lot of the world didn't know how bad it really is over there. Well, this guy, Irvin, he's got a fax machine. And what he starts doing is he starts faxing some of his important contacts from around the world. Okay. Letting them know
what's going on,
how bad the city is, and how... Because there's not, it's kind of like no one knows how bad it really is there.
Right. So this is early on. This is before we were involved.
This is before anybody was involved. Like, the UN's not doing much. France is kind of sort of involved, but that's about it. And so, because there's not a good response, at least in the book, they don't really have a good response to these people shelling them from out in the woods, out in the mountains. And these guys out in the mountains have these, like, long range cannons and stuff that are just dropping these big bombs down on them.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, they've shot up the hotels, they've shot up the, like, restaurants, they've shot up the hospitals, the whole bit. So at one point, this grocery store, on the bottom level of this big concrete building, they put sandbags around the bottom of this grocery store, they make it into a hospital. And so there's, like, a hospital there that's, like, I guess kind of down the street from where they're living at and that kind of thing. And this guy, Irvin, is, like, really well-known. Like, that's ends up being big time for this guy, because all these people in town kind of know who he is, or at least a lot of people do. A lot of, like, some reporters know who he is. He's, like I said, he's got contacts kind of around the world. Some contacts that are, like, you know, like I said, artists and things like that. So, He starts sending these faxes out. Now the faxes are going through a satellite fax, which I didn't know they had satellite faxes, but apparently there's some kind of satellite fax that they're doing.
Well, it went through the telephone, so if you'd use a satellite phone, I would assume you could do it.
Yeah, I guess.
But I'm not an expert on fax or satellite technology.
I mean, I don't know how any of that works, but you know, they talk about that. And so he would get these faxes out, and then he would, you know, send them to all these different people. And sometimes he would send the same one to various people because he didn't have time to write out new ones and stuff. And so what Joe Kubert did was, and apparently there were maybe thousands of these faxes, but Joe Kubert gathered them up that he was getting, and he was sending them back to this guy also, because he really liked this guy. In fact, a year or two before Sarajevo got shelled, Joe Kubert and his wife took a vacation there, and they they walked around. This guy showed them around. They walked around the old city, and because that city had been there for hundreds of years or whatever. And so Joe Kubert and his wife, you know, had traveled there. They knew this guy's family really well and all that. So when this all happened, you know, a lot of people like Joe Kubert were like, man, they're really worried about this guy and his family.
Right.
Like, what can we do to get this guy out of there? And so people were calling, like, their congressmen and people like that. What can we do? The different groups like that, you know, can we pull some strings? Is it possible? And really, it's not really possible, but they're trying. They're trying all they can do to help this out, help this guy get out of there. And this book is, it actually has the faxes in here printed. Now, not all of them, because I said there's hundreds, if not thousands, of these faxes. But some of the faxes are printed in here. And then what Joe Kubert did was, he took the faxes and he illustrated about 11 or 12 pages of story after each fax that he puts in here. And so you've got like 12 chapters, and then the chapters might start off with the fax, and then it might go into 10 or 12 pages of art. And there might be some other faxes thrown into that kind of move the story along. And a lot of them are from Irvin to his friends, but then some of them are actually like to Joe Kubert and his wife Muriel, back to this guy and his family. But this guy's got a trek. Like, at one point, they think they can get him out of there, and they're gonna say, okay, well, we're gonna try to get you out of here. We got some stuff lined up. What we need you to do is we need you to get to Sarajevo, and we're gonna have some people waiting on you and that kind of thing. So he has like this little Opel car.
Oh yeah,
like an Opel Kadett. Yeah, yeah. I think it's like an Opel Kadett, right? I think it's what it is.
I didn't know if you're, when you said Opel, I didn't know if you're going with Opel Gem or Opel Colored or what.
Yeah, it's like an Opel.
I didn't think about Opel car.
I think it's a Kadett is what it, I think that's what it is. It's a gotcha. Little bitty car. And so what they've done is this one area of the town where it's getting really bad sniper fire, they parked a bunch of like big trucks along this route, and the idea was you could drive a car behind the trucks and maybe the snipers wouldn't shoot you in your car because these trucks are kind of blocking their view.
Oh, yeah.
But there's still gaps between the trucks. Right. Right. So he gets his family in the car and they go over to Sarajevo and it didn't work out. They have to go back and they're getting shot at the whole way and all this business. And that happens. He goes over there sometimes by himself, sometimes with them. At one point they said, oh, if you can get to the airport and you can get across the airport, like the tarmac, and get to the other side, you might be able to escape up the mountains. And people.
Oh, so he's not going to the airport to get on a plane.
No.
He's going out
to try to get across it. And so at one point, him and his family, and he's got like a wife, and he's got these two kids, like the daughter's not quite 10, and the son's like maybe 4 or 5. So like little kids. And it's, oh yeah, by the way, it's like freezing. Like they've got like light jackets on, but it's like the dead of winter.
Oh yeah, it gets cold there.
They've got like tennis shoes on, not boots. You know, they don't have any like clothing for the time of year it is now, because this has been going on for a while. So they get there to the fence. They find the hole in the fence where someone's cut the fence up. They're crawling under it. Meanwhile, people are coming out as they're going in because people are smuggling goods in. Getting shot at, smuggling goods, and they're trying to get out. And like every night, people try to get out this route, and like always, like 20 people get shot and killed. you know, that kind of thing. And you got,
yeah, they're just, they know they're going that way, so they're just kicking them off.
Yeah, there's waiting for them, right? And then once they get under the fence and they're up on the flat area where there's no trees and stuff, now they're kind of, they're doing it dead of night, there's lights on them, and anyways, they get stopped, and luckily it's the UN guys, not the Serbs or whatever. And so they go, oh, you got to go back. And the thing is, the UN guys are kind of there, the fighters, but unless you have the right papers, they won't help you get out.
Oh, geez.
So they'll see you maybe, but they'll send you right back. They'll go, nope, you can't do it. You got to go. And so him and his family had to go all the way back. And it was like, I want to say it's like 8 miles or so through this tough environment, getting shot at and that kind of thing. Somehow they're not, and people are dying by the thousands.
Right.
I mean, people are literally, they're lining people up and shooting them in the street. They're mass burying people. People are dead in the street. There's cars that are blown up. At one point, there's like a pack of wild dogs because there's no owners now. So all these wild dogs are running crazy in the city. And at one point, his son gets really sick because they're living in the basement of a building for a while. His son gets really ill. So he gets his son in the car and takes his son to the hospital. And they give him some medicine or whatever to get him back. And at one point, he leaves the car with them because their ambulance gets destroyed. He goes, okay, you can have my car. Uses an ambulance. And then at one point, he needs his car later on. He goes back, and they've, like, put pieces of metal on the side of his car.
Oh, yeah, to keep from getting shot up.
Yeah, they've
or to keep them from getting shot in the car.
They've metaled up the side of his car, and he looks in the back, and there's all these magazines and comic books. And he's like, what's up with all these magazines and comic books? And the doctor tells him, oh, we got the metal there, so no one to get shot, because we're using your car as an ambulance now. But by the way, it's an Opel. It's a tiny little car.
Right.
But the comic books and the magazines, if you put two or three around you, it might deflect a bullet.
Like, yeah.
Okay, have you seen a comic book? There's no way a comic book's deflected any bullet.
Well, they're the European hardcovers.
The albums.
Yeah.
So, it is a tough story to read, man. I mean, because he's trying to get out. And at one point, and every time he about gets out, something happens. Nope. So at one point he finds out. He goes, well, they tell him, they leave the hotel there. Okay, so his house they had, at one point the tanks come down the street. They made it to his neighborhood, and they just start blowing up every building on his street. So him and his wife and kids have to literally leave their place. And their whole building gets totally destroyed. All their belongings are gone. And that's just why they didn't have the proper clothes for being outside, right?
Yeah.
Then what they do is they move to this, they get to this apartment building. They live in this apartment building for a while. And then they go, hey, if you guys come over here to Sarajevo, we'll try to get you out on one of these planes. They go over there. When they go over there, they give up their apartment. So now some new people move in their apartment. They can't go back there now. They end up moving to this, they move into a Holiday Inn. And this Holiday Inn it's getting shelled, but not as bad because reporters are living there from all across the world or whatever. So it's been rented out by reporters, but he kind of knows a guy that, he knows people all over the place. So it kind of reminds me of Vladek in Miles because, you know, how that guy knew a lot of stuff and he was able to kind of make his way through the system and not get killed because he could repair shoes or people owed him favors or whatever. Well, this guy knows so many people that, oh yeah, we know you. Or at one point when they moved, when his wife's father was looking for him, they knew who he was. Like, oh yeah, he moved over here now. Like, that kind of stuff didn't work out for anybody else, but it does for him pretty well, actually. Anyways, they're moving to this Holiday Inn. They're living there for a while. And he finds out that if you get a, since you're already working in publishing, if you can get a reporter credentials, you might be able to get out as a reporter on one of the reporter transport planes. Because then they'll let you get out if you can get one of these credentials that you're a reporter. So he gets one, and they go, well, that's good for you, but not for your wife and kids. So then he has to make up his mind if he's going to actually leave or not, leave his wife or kids behind. And he has to decide, well, getting them out, staying there is not working out. So he leaves, kind of reluctantly, leaves them there. And he's gone for like over a month with them living in the worst conditions. And he gets out, he goes to Split, Croatia, and at one point he goes on down to some other little cities down by the Adriatic Ocean or whatnot. And then he ends up going to Rome, Italy, going to a couple other places, talking to all these, like, department of this or that, meeting with these all these high-up people. Hey, can you pull some strings for me and my family? And they're like, well, you know, you and your family, we can't really pull strings for you guys. You know, thousands of people over there dying. But what he finds out is so working outside's not working for him either. So he's maybe going to have to go back to just smuggle himself back into or go back on a plane with the rest of the reporters back into Sarajevo and just live with his wife and kids, because he's kind of come to the end of his rope. He's really worried about him. His wife's kind of having some nervous breakdowns. The kids are freaking out. He's just got to go back. And then kind of at the last straw, he applies to get citizenship of Slovakia. And right before he goes back, they grant him citizenship. And the only way he can get citizenship is he has to prove that he could bring something good to that country, that they'd want him to come there and be be a Slovakic citizen.
Yeah, yeah, something to add, he had some kind of talent or skill they needed.
Right, because otherwise everybody wants to come there, right?
Right.
So what do you got? Well, yeah, he's sort of a reporter, but not really, but he runs his publishing house, whatever. But what he did was he had people from all over the world that knew of him write them letters to the consulate or whatever, and that pushed him over the top, and he gets this fax saying, they've approved you a citizenship, and within like a week, your wife and kids will get it since you are. And so he was just getting ready to fly back, but he stayed. And then his wife and kids barely got on an American plane. They weren't letting any civilians ride that plane that day because the weather was so bad. But one of the reporters that he knew, another guy that he had known that had met him before, saw his wife and kids were going to get on the plane. They told him no. That guy went up to the guy who wasn't letting people in, and he taught that guy, you got to let these people in. They've been trying to get out of this country for like a year. And so the guy kind of reluctantly let them get on the plane, so his wife and kids were able to get out and make it to where he was at in Croatia. So it was a hell of a story based on real-life events told through these faxes that were sent back and forth that Joe Kubert had collected. Some, like I said, he'd sent the guy, but most of it came to him. I'm going to read you a passage, though, a dramatic reading. Now, one of these, there's two faxes here. One is from Irvin, going to Joe Kubert, and the other one's Joe sending one back. And these are dated July the 20th, 1992. And Joe says Monday on it, so it was a Monday, July the 20th, 1992. So this is Irvin, I can't read his signature, but it's Irvin, sentence to Joe Kubert. It says, today is Maj's 10th birthday. Adina prepared a very modest celebration under constant gunfire and detonations of exploding grenades. Still, we felt somehow happy, mostly because we were all still alive. And then only 1 hour ago, I get the information that the Serbs have burned down the office building and that nothing is left there. All the originals, all the life memories, photographs, negatives, all our children, of our children, everything that I collected and bringing them with very much care, very much love, everything is gone forever. So you can tell his English is, you know.
Yeah.
All the originals, all the life memories, you know, everything's gone forever. You, Joe, and Muriel, who were in my office, know very well how much all of that did mean to me, how much I was proud of the original of Prince Valiant from 1956, dedicated to me from Foster.
Oh, geez.
And all the other 12.
Oh, my gosh.
And all the other 12,000 originals that I had there. Adina can't stop crying, and I was hiding my tears from her. More than one half of my life has been burned down, and a great part of hers. I was spending all my time in that office and very seldom with her and the children. Still, we should be happy to be alive, but for how long? And you find out he had stuff from Charles Schultz and Herman and just a lot of people he had like original stuff from.
Oh,
it,
man.
It all got destroyed. How about a real original Prince Valiant page from that Foster had signed to him? This is what Joe Kubert says back.
Yeah.
Dear Irwin, Adina, Maha, and Edwin, the kids. It is a very difficult thing to try to celebrate a young lady's 10th birthday under such terrible conditions, but you must all console yourselves by the fact that Mahal's next birthday will be different. I know that none of us outside can even imagine the horrors you are all experiencing. Nevertheless, you must think of better tomorrow. No matter how difficult it is, you have no options, no choices. To think otherwise is to capitulate to the barbarians. And that is exactly what they want, Dan. There is no accountability and no justice. So that you cannot do. The office, the artwork, the collections, in comparison to you and your family, Irvin, they are nothing. When you and your family get out, you'll start with a fresh, clean slate, and the past will give tremendous, non-stoppable momentum to the future, and the future is everything. You will survive, and you will get out, and when you do, all your friends will be there to greet you whenever, wherever and whenever it is. Hold together, Irvin. Each day brings you closer to that time. You must believe it. Love to all, Joe. I think what Joe says there, a lot of people can take that in their life. You know, if shit gets you down, you got to believe that things are going to get better and, you know, that kind of thing. Your stuff you collect and all is cool and all, but, I mean, nothing beats just being around and being here, you know?
Yeah,
and,
I mean...
And Joe has some real straight talk to this guy, and I think that really helped the guy out, you know? I mean, the guy was really down because you can imagine he had...
Yeah, he lost a lot of cool stuff.
He did in his office and all the work he did, not only his stuff he collected, but his work. He had pages of original work that he worked on and things he'd done. And it all was burnt up too. There's another page I marked here is because it lists some of his friends that were working for him. A writer named Martin Lodgwick, and that guy's from Holland, I think. I never heard of him. Then in Brussels, there's the cartoonist Herman. In Switzerland, artist Hugo Pratt. In Holland, there's another guy. I don't have his name here. And then, of course, in Dover, New Jersey's Joe Kubert. And then some other, there's some high-end Jewish guys at some synagogue in Brooklyn that are trying to pull some strings, too. You find out that Irvin, he's living in Sarajevo. He didn't know it at the time, but he didn't know what he is. I think he assumed he was Jewish, but come to find out he was Muslim, and he didn't even know it. But he talks about, he has friends from Jewish friends, Muslim friends, you know, he's got all kind of friends, and nobody ever cared about what he was or what he wasn't. No one even took a second thought about that, Catholic, whatever. Not that they cared, the snipers don't know who they're shooting anybody.
Right.
But yeah, it's a hell of a story. It's another one of those stories like Mouse or like I said, the Tardy books.
Or the Alamo book.
Yeah, probably a happier ending than the Alamo story, though, actually.
Yeah, So several years ago, Michelle and I went to New York, and we went to the Museum of Modern Art. And they had an exhibit there of Yugoslavian architecture.
Okay.
Now, you may go, why would they have that? Well, the reason why is because for years, Yugoslavia had this... They built a ton of these very distinct, I'm going to call them concrete-type buildings. And I'm going to show you some of them here on my phone. Oops. I'm going to attempt to show you some here on my phone. Well, it's not going to work. But, I mean, you can see, like, that's one of them. Kind of futuristic looking. But they built them from, like, the 40s till the...
It looks like something from Roy Roberts' City of the Future.
Oh, yeah.
City of Tomorrow.
Like, These are all buildings.
That was like that's like the Oral Roberts hands or something, wasn't it?
No.
Go back one. What's that thing doing this? What is that?
I don't know.
It's not a building. What is
it? Yeah, it's a building. They're all buildings.
But how come it's sitting sideways?
I have no idea.
Huh, okay.
They're all, the architectural style is called Yugoslavian brutalism.
Brutalism?
Well, brutalism is a style of architecture, and it has to do with, it uses heavy concrete forms.
Well, they could use that when they were getting shelled.
Well, so in 84, and so there were all these buildings that were built, and this show that we went to at the moment had a bunch of pictures, had architectural models, had all this stuff from probably like 60 years worth of building these types of buildings. They kind of, there was a whole movement
mm-hmm.
within the country, and when the war broke out, well, in fact, kind of the pinnacle of it was in the, I think it was 84 Winter Olympics, they built all these stadiums and stuff in that style. And when the war broke out, a lot of that stuff was destroyed.
There's a bridge in here that shows, I forgot to tell you real quick, the back probably 20 pages of the book are photos,
right? Oh, yeah.
They're photos. And I need to say this about the book real quick. The book, it's dedicated to this guy, Kirim.
Is he eating a sandwich in that
he
picture?
He is eating a sandwich.
Okay.
Kirim Zymovic. Kirim Zymovic. And you can see in this photo, he's eating a sandwich. And also, you can see, like, there's Jim Carrey's Riddler.
What is it, like a...
From, like, Batman.
Like a back of a comic or something?
Maybe it's like Batman Forever or whatever. Whatever one Jim Carrey was in, right?
The bad one.
So, this book is dedicated to this guy because this kid is the one that took all these photos. And you find out...
Oh, okay.
And you find out that... So, Irvin sent all these faxes, but this kid, Kirim, took all these photos. And there is a lot of photos in here. And you find out that he sent 4 packages of photos to Joe Kubert, and that's kind of also what Kubert used for some of the style of the buildings and things like that in this book, right? So you've got these photos and then buildings that have been shot up and that kind of thing, cars, like a war zone, and Kubert used that when he did all this artwork in here, right? So, hey, it's nice. Thanks, Kirim, for sending all these packages, these 4 packages of all these photos. Well, this Kirim guy was a huge comic book fan. And he just landed a job at this company called, this local publisher called Danny, D-A-N-I. And he was going to work for them. And they do comics and stuff. And this kid was going to start working for him. I was so excited. And you can see he's reading this Batman comic or whatever. And unfortunately, Kirim died when a grenade wound hit him in the head in August of 95. He was 24 years old.
Oh, man.
So, probably right after they got out, their buddy Kirim here, who didn't leave, a grenade went off and a piece of shrapnel hit him in the head and killed him. So, if you look at these photos he sent back, there's actually some photos here that Joe Kubert and his wife are in, plus the buildings. And at one point, Joe Kubert and his wife are walking over this bridge. One of these first photos. They're walking over this bridge, right? And you find out this bridge is hundreds of years old. This bridge right here.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't see it very good from this angle here because they're walking across. It's kind of up with it, you know, on the same level they're on.
Right.
But in the comic, he draws it, and sure enough, the Serbs blew that bridge up. It's this huge concrete bridge, hundreds of years old, and the Serbs took it out with some tanks. And it took a lot of hits. There's pictures of it, like, pot-marked, and then it came down or whatever. So they're shooting... At one point in the book, they said there's not one pane of glass in Serbia that's not either cracked or shattered. And this is like a big metropolitan area.
Oh, yeah.
And they'd been shooting at this city for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, something. Fires going on all the time. Busted cars just littered the street. F- funny thing was, these cars are all shot to shit. His Opel took all kind of shots. I mean, it drove back and forth from the town they lived in to Serbia.
It was the comic books.
And it got
comic books stopped.
It got shot up. It got shot to hell. There's a picture of it in here, actually, with the armor.
Oh, really?
With the armor on it, yeah. I'll have to show you that real quick. But, like, I don't know why they didn't try to shoot out the tires. You know, maybe they did. That's, I don't know. But this car went back and forth.
They've never played Car Wars, or they would know you got to aim
for
the tires.
At one point, he's driving, he's like, I feel like a Mad Max. Here's the car. Here's the car at the hospital. It's got, like, paneling and stuff on it.
Yeah, first off, small doesn't quite describe that car. And, yeah, you can see it's pretty pockmarked.
It's shot bullets. Up, man. Like, if you shoot the where do you get another tire at? If that tire's gone, where do you get another tire for this thing at, right? I mean, this car, like, there's no passenger, there's no driver window. It's like, they put these plates over the windows and stuff.
Well, dude, you shoot right through that glass.
Oh, yeah, I know. But, yeah, man, it's if you like real stories, like war stories, I put this up there. I mean, it's not Mouse, it's not like the Tardy books, but, man, it's pretty good.
Well, and also, it's a little different than some of that stuff, because that's relatively recent history.
Oh, when this came out, though, this is like none.
Right.
This happened, like, just a couple, like a year or two before this came out, right?
Right, so, yeah. That conflict, I mean, you know, that was in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, I say conflict, that, and I don't understand all the
it was ethnic cleansing is what it was.
Right, it was basically, the one group or tribe or whatever was against the other, but I don't know if it was, I don't know how they even knew who was who.
Well,
I mean, it was, I guess
they had this dictator, Mazalov or something like that.
Yeah.
And he had these, and I don't think they were real army. I think they were just these guys that they might have been the real army, but I don't know if they were completely the real army. Or maybe it was the army that tried to overthrow Serbia, or they were Serbian, almost like a terrorist cell kind of guys that he financed, and they were up there with these guns, like blowing the shit out of the city.
Yeah.
And I guess, since, I don't know if it's because the country broke apart or what, I guess Bosnia maybe didn't have any army. I don't know how it worked, but supposedly it was a really peaceful, really beautiful country.
Yeah.
They had the Olympics there, like you said.
Like in 84, I think it was.
They had skiing there. They had
Winter Olympics.
Yeah, he had a shot of that he drew of on a memory of somebody. Oh, man, this place, they used to snow ski here in the Olympics, and now it's all shot to hell. So,
yeah, that was part of that thing at the MoMA we went to, is they'd show a building and they'd show what was left of it now, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And like you say, it wasn't just snipers. I don't know if they had an Air Force where they're bombing stuff, but they were definitely like launching mortars and artillery and stuff.
They had planes.
I think they did until we started enforce the no-fly zone thing.
They had planes. And they flew low through the city, low enough to where the vibrations of the planes would bust that glass, too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and there's one scene in the book that he draws it, but they also talk about it, that at one point, the girl, the lady, Adina, her dad comes to visit them. And they don't live anywhere near where they used to live, but he found out where they're at. He makes the trek over there. They're living in the hotel or whatever. He shows up. He's an old guy. He's really old, right? He's probably in his 70s. You know, he's no spring chicken. He makes it over there, sees them and the kids, because he thinks they're leaving the next day, because it looked like they didn't, but he thought they were. It looked like they were going to leave. He found out. He shows up. Oh, man, can you come with us? No, I'm not going to leave the country. I'm staying or whatever. Oh, Grandpa, please go. No, we're staying. And so they look out the window, and they see him leaving. He tells them bye. He goes downstairs, because they're living on like the fourth floor of this Holiday Inn or whatever. They see him down there, and he's walking, and he looks back, and he's waving at him, and this bomb comes down, like, right next to him, and blows up, and just shit goes everywhere, it's smoky, and they're looking down, and they think he's been vaporized, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they literally think he's been vaporized.
Yeah, sure.
And even the smoke clears, he's still waving at him, and they go, what the hell? And the dad, Irvin, goes, oh, look, he got really lucky. If they would have hit the sidewalk or the street, he would have gotten killed, but it hit the soft ground and it went down the ground enough to where when it blew up, it blew straight up and it didn't blow out. So the force...
I thought you said it went in a manhole.
No, the force went up and it didn't kill him. Instead of going out, it went straight up and so it didn't kill him. And he was still sitting there waving.
You know, my grandfather was in the Navy in World War II, and before my dad was born, by the way. And he was in the Navy in World War II. And I don't know what he did on the ship, but he wasn't a guy shooting down planes or, you know, doing whatever.
He's a cook.
Well, I don't know what he did. So when they were in battle, he was below deck.
Yeah.
Right? Well,
what boat was he on?
Oh, I forget. The Missouri?
I'll accept that.
Okay. Anyway, I know he was on the Missouri. No, he was on the Missouri at one point, but I don't know what boat he was on at this point. Yeah. Anyway, apparently there was a torpedo that some other, the Japanese shot at their boat or their ship, and it went through the hull and it went right like where they were, all the guys that weren't doing anything. They went to like a safe spot. But the torpedo didn't blow up, and just kind of lodged in the wall there.
But now water's coming in, right?
Well, I don't know if it was above. I think it was. I mean, whatever it did, it didn't kill him.
Wow.
You know, but if it had gone off, it probably would have killed him.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah, you know, that would have been the end of my origin story.
I'd be sitting at the podcast with somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
Wowzers.
Yeah.
That's too close to call.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, do you want to talk about that, or do you want to
move on? Let me. I'll just talk about it real quick. I got one thing I wanted to talk about, just because I've been reading this lately. I'm sure I've mentioned on the podcast I'm a big John Byrne fan. I think you're a big John Byrne fan too. And back in, God, when did this come out? I don't know when he did this. 90s? Late 90s? Yeah. 98 and 99. So in the late 90s, John Byrne wrote, penciled, and inked. May have even lettered it, but I don't know if he did.
It's just 12 issues, right?
He did a book called Spider-Man Chapter 1. Actually, it's 13 issues.
Okay.
It's 13 issues because there's a zero issue.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, what it was, Marvel wanted him to reimagine Spider-Man.
Kind of like the Superman thing he did?
No. Did you not read these when they came out?
No, I did.
Okay, so
when you said reimagine, I thought it was like, oh,
well,
you were
no.
With Superman.
No, what he did, I'll tell you what he did, is he went back and he took the first 12 issues of Spider-Man and took the story and rewrote it and redrew it. So it's basically like the story is identical within changing of the first 12 issues of Spider-Man. So what Marvel was trying to do was
replace Ted Steve Ditko.
Well, well, but I mean he rewrote it. There's changes to the plots and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But he basically followed the same story arc. But but Marvel's idea was they wanted a Spider-Man series that new readers could read to show like early Spider-Man stories. At the time, they hadn't done. A little bit later, they did like Spider-Man Adventures. That was the same kind of thing, but more. More of a kid kind of thing. This was aimed more at like regular comic fans, and I think the series failed.
Let me ask you this then: why didn't they just reprint the Steve Ditko?
Well, he was trying to update it for modern audiences. What the deal was? But yeah, I'm with you. Just reprint the Steve Ditko stuff. But you can see this is very late '90s coloring.
Yeah, not real big on that.
Yeah, not real big on that either. But. So it was the first 12 issues, and there's a zero issue, and the zero issue is out of order because it's three stories. It's the origin of the Vulture, the Lizard Man, or the Lizard, not the Lizard Man, the Lizard and Sandman. So it's not really part of the continuity. For some reason, this trade, they put it kind of in the middle. I don't know if that's where it goes into it, but I've been rereading this, or I've been reading this, and I really kind of dig it.
Well, you had the singles of that, right?
I have bought the singles when they came out, yeah. But I picked up this trade cheap somewhere, probably at Half Price Books. It's a $34.90, it's a $35 trade. You could still get it for that. It's still in print. I thought maybe it was out of print, but it's still in print. The series did not sell very well. I like it. I think John Byrne's art is pretty good in here. It's not my favorite period of his art, but it's pretty good. The coloring, like you say, is a little much.
It's too computer looking.
It's too computer looking, in my opinion. For sure, I would agree with that. But I dig it. The bad thing is they did it and it didn't, and John Byrne complained that Marvel didn't promote it, and the fans complained. They were like, well, so one of the complaints was, let me see if I can find an example in here. So, you know, the early issues of Spider-Man focuses on him as a teenager, and people were like, well, John Byrne doesn't know how to draw teenagers, which, you know, you can take that or leave that. But then they were like, well, he doesn't know how to draw a teenager. The fashion, people complained about, well, they're not really wearing the right clothes or whatever. You know, who knows about that? I mean, that's kind of, you know, it's like, eh.
Yeah, sweater vest needs to go.
Well, and I don't know if kids dress like that necessarily.
Well, those jorts.
Yeah, maybe, you know. But John Byrne has never been a guy.
But to me, that's not worth harping on.
No. But at a certain point in around this time in comics, that started to be a thing for some people. It's like, oh, look, the fashion is important. John Byrne kind of goes back to the era where that wasn't really a thing.
I wish he would have redid the first, was it 37 issues? The first, that's Ditko.
Oh, of Ditko's run?
I just can't stand it, Ditko art in his book. And people are like, oh, Ditko. Ditko did a lot of good things. I don't like the Ditko first 30, whatever his issues of Spider-Man were. To me, Spider-Man is not good until the Romita stuff. That's just me.
Well, I'm not going to get into that, but
if you would redo the first 37 or whatever,
who did the first 12?
I would be, oh wow.
Well, Marvel canceled the book. I don't know if it's planned as a year long thing, but never did well. And then John Byrne's beef was they didn't support it, and they canceled it again. I don't know if, well, it ended. It may have just only been planned for 12. But then not long after this, they did the Ultimate Spider-Man.
Oh.
And yeah. they redid the whole thing. And he kind of was complaining because, like, yeah, you know, Spider-Man doesn't appear in his costume for, I don't know, the first 5 issues or something like that. It's a whole different thing, you know. Brian Bendis had a whole different take on it. He wasn't trying to redo the first...
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Byrne apparently was told to stay pretty close to the first issues or whatever. Well,
and the Bendis stuff, and I could get Byrne's pissed about stuff. I get that. But
the Byrne's always pissed about stuff.
Exactly. And then also the Bendis stuff was, that's a whole different character, a whole other universe. You know, that Ultimate,
well, yeah.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That is true.
I mean,
but at the time, when those came out, that wasn't as clearly. We didn't know what they were going to do with the Ultimate Universe.
We had your regular Spider-Man. You had your Ultimate Spider-Man. It's
right.
A completely different thing.
Yeah, but
you know, it's like the Ultimates. It's the Avengers Ultimates. That was their own thing. You know.
Well, anyway, I've been reading this. And I like it. When I was a kid, I had those paperback reprints of the first, you know, it had like 6 issues in each one. I think I had 3 or 4 Spider-Man.
You had a cover on that?
Oh, yeah, I put a plastic cover on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been carrying it to work, so I didn't want it to get too destroyed in my bag.
Do those covers come off when you put those on there?
Nope.
That's it, huh?
Yeah.
What if you get like a air bubble or something in it? How do you get that out?
You can usually work them out, or if you cut it, you can let the air out and just really, you know. Yeah. I've done that on a couple books.
You do that to a lot of your books. What are you talking about?
I do that to a lot of my books.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did to this X-Men book over here. But anyway, I kind of dig that. But
you come from that too?
Yeah.
Oh, wowzers.
This is the one I normally, since I retired my other X-Men book, this is the one I carry in my bag with me now.
Mm-hmm.
Since that one got signed, I retired. This is a newer printing. The coloring's been redone.
Oh, yeah.
And it's thinner.
Well, the paper's different. The paper stock's different.
And this one...
It's not newsprint.
It's not newsprint. I don't think it has... Yeah, it's missing... The other one has a Stan Lee introduction. This is missing that.
Oh, okay.
It has the covers... What is this? Hang on. Yeah, it's got the covers from when they redid it in the classic X-Men books, which... I think those covers are terrible, but it has, that one's by John Byrne, I believe.
Are you picking up the classic omnibus when it comes out?
I've got the first one.
No, the classic,
This?
No, the X-Men.
Do you mean of the
Hidden Years, the Hidden Years is what I'm talking about, the Hidden Years.
Oh, no, I got the trades.
Okay. Yeah, they're doing an omnibus of that.
Oh, are they?
Mm-hmm.
I got both trades. The trades are out of print. They're kind of pricey.
Mm.
Anyway, it's got a couple of the art pages. And then I think... Oh, yeah, it would have been the splash page had Phoenix lived for the next issue.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
That's not in the other one. But, yeah. Oh, that reminds me. I saw on the John Byrne forum that they're gonna re-release the Artifact Edition, the X-Men, John Byrne X-Men book.
The Artifact Edition?
Was the hard... They're going to do the hardcover.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Not a small... Not an artisan...
Artisan, not the artisan. It's the Artifact.
It's the Artifact because they have complete stories in it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When's that coming out?
I think this summer,
but maybe. But you've already got it.
I've got it, yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm off those. I think I'm just going to stick with the Artisans.
The Artisans are pretty nice.
They're not hardcover, but, you know, they'll sit on your bookshelf at least.
Yeah, those artist editions are... And you see, I still got the one sitting on my coffee table.
Yeah.
I need to take it up. That one's worse than most of them because it's got a slipcase.
I would probably level that up there and just stack them on top of that thing.
Yeah, that's probably what I need to do.
I'd level it. Looks like you got that one. Might be bowed.
That book was bowed on the shelf when I got it, so... Oh. Because they had it against the wall up on top of a shelf.
Yeah, it'll work.
Yeah, so. It's so big. It's super unwieldy.
Well, let's do this. Let's wrap this episode up right here. As always, I've been your host, D.L. Nelson, joined by my other host,
Scott Sackett.
Check out our blog at betterthanfictionthepodcast.blogspot.com, where you can look at photos of all the cool stuff we've talked about tonight, including Joe Kubert's real life story called Facts from Sarajevo and X-Men Dark Phoenix Saga Scott just mentioned, plus his John Byrne Spider-Man Chapter 1, and of course the Art of John Romita hardcover that's making me jealous. Also, if you look at our blog, you can see if they scroll down to the very bottom, you can click the link and listen to our episode right there. Don't have to go to any kind of server, just play it right through the blog site.
Excellent. And if you enjoyed our podcast, please take a second to leave a review and subscribe. This will help other people find our podcast. Also, thank you once again to our sponsor, Air 51 Comics in Pensacola, Florida. If you're traveling through the panhandle of Florida, stop into Pensacola on West Navy Boulevard and say hi to Jim.
Tell him Better Than Fiction sent you.
Yep.
And with that, we'll say, hey, come back next week for another all-new episode, and we'll have more awesomeness to share, and maybe a cup of coffee. And with that, we'll say, see ya! Next week.